Normally, I have taken the opportunity to introduce all of the priests who got up and gave their testimonies, and tonight you have me. So, at least my wife is happy to hear me. So, which you think she'd hear enough of me, but never mind that. So, I am going to start off by giving the point of my message and sort of do one of those odd literary techniques and get to the end and give you the conclusion at the very beginning. And the conclusion is that God has plans for us which we don't know except in hindsight. And had we known about them, we might not have taken those paths. This was a common theme in Father David's messages, if you've ever heard him say this time and time again. In theological terms, this is sometimes called prevenient grace, the grace that comes before. So that's the conclusion. So if I get there and it's kind of lost in the story, the point is, God knew this plan long before I ever got there, and as rocky of a road as it was, looking back on it, it seems very clear now, and as grumblesome as it might be, it was a good plan. So, we were having a conversation maybe 2 weeks ago at our weekly priest's prayer early in the morning, and someone commented about how surprised they were with someone's testimony and what they anticipated, how they thought mine was going to go, and somebody else laughed because they were like, that's not his story. So someone recently said, weren't you born in a foreign country? And it's like, yeah, Ohio. So yes, I was born in the thriving metropolis of Columbus, Ohio, just a few months after Father Melanson's oldest son was born. Just to put some perspective on things. Have to get that ding in there. So, yeah, he is old. He is old. I'm going to pretend I didn't hear any of that. So, kind of check the time here, because we've been giving each other grief about how long everybody took for like the last 3 weeks now. So, I was born in Columbus, Ohio, and shortly thereafter, I think I was born in December, that I know, and I think it was the next February, I was baptized in a small Roman Catholic church. And apparently, yeah, they didn't redo it. Something that that's obviously kind of the elephant on the coffee table is my testimony obviously involves some other people in here, but when you're telling your story, you should only tell your story, okay? You shouldn't, it's kind of like when you go to confession. Obviously, sometimes you didn't sin by yourself, but you don't confess other people's sins, okay? You say what you did, okay? So when you're telling your testimony, you shouldn't be telling other people's story. So as much as possible, this is my story. If you want to ask other sides of the story, well, I'll talk to somebody else later on. Okay, so let's get that out of the way. When I was about a year and a half old, my father took a job with an oil company in Saudi Arabia. And for the next roughly 10 years, we lived in the desert in Saudi Arabia. My dad was a high voltage electrician, and I grew up in Saudi Arabia. And that was a desert. They will deny this, but I remember walking to school with my shirt pulled up over to my nose so the sand wouldn't get in my face. People were like, oh man, I remember walking when it was a rainstorm and all that. Yeah. Uphill both ways, It wasn't that bad. It was just, and really, it was a good place to grow up. There was no danger. There was no. We had like armed guards with AK-47s at the gate to make sure that nobody got in and messed with us. Because at that time, they liked the Americans, and they wanted to make sure that we were safe and happy. Okay? So like every morning, I would get up and go to the beach with my mom, and we would go and swim in the Persian Gulf. And that was nice. And then we'd walk back home, and we had a bottle of turpentine on the back porch so we could get tar off our feet, because there was a lot of oil in the Persian Gulf. So, okay, whatever. But that whole time, you know, there was not a church in the town that we lived, because, you know, the Arabs weren't real big on that. So, you know, it was a desert. It was a desert, you know, geographically, but you could also say it was a desert spiritually. So there was no, like, hey, let's all go to church on Sundays, okay? So at the end of that time that we were there, I had really bad asthma that was only complicated by the fact that we didn't live very far from an oil refinery. And so my mom and I ended up coming back to the States. And my parents had decided that they had had enough of shoveling snow, and they decided they were going to move to Florida because they thought that would never happen again in Florida. And so they moved back to, well, my mom and I moved back to Jacksonville, where my mom's parents had already settled. They had taken a job with another oil company, and they had done their time in Saudi Arabia, and they had come back and taken up residence in Florida. And so we moved back to Florida. My dad continued to work in Saudi Arabia for another year and then followed us back home. So we settled back in Jacksonville. We were living in Bay Meadows, over in the actual Bay Meadows apartments. And, you know, that was really good life because it was a tremendous financial blessing to have worked for that oil company because it was a really boom time, and they made a ton of money. Okay, now that made enough money for them to put me in private school when I got back, which was a good thing, and for them to both go to college and both get degrees on what they had made when they were there, and they did that off of the savings that they made. So they made a bunch of money. So good for them, okay? And when I got through with the 3 years of the private school, fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, I ended up going to Stanton, okay? At that time, Stanton had a seventh and eighth grade, and they phased it out when I was there. So I was the last class that had seventh grade. I was the last class that had eighth grade. Now Stanton's only a ninth and tenth grade class, or 9 through 12, excuse me. And again, that whole time, I maybe went to church 4 or 5 times, okay? Church was not a part of my life. Now, when I got to Stanton, I don't remember if it was 8th or 9th grade, but we were going over selecting my schedule, and my mother said, "You need to take debate." Okay. I liked the concept of taking debate. It seemed like a good idea. I liked arguing, so why not? And it turned out I was pretty good at it. This is not supposed to be funny. But I did really well in it. And it became something that I did throughout my high school career. Some people are like, you know, hey, we're in the glee club, or we're in the, you know, we do football or we do soccer or whatever. I was in debate. That was my thing. And we didn't have a football team. That's a different part of the story. I'll get there in a little bit. So I did debate, and I got to be really good at it. I did actual technical debate, two guys, opposite tables, folders, you know, affirmative argument, negative argument, switch sides, go back and forth. I did that for maybe 2 years, and then I switched events. I did something called Student Congress, which everybody, all those different schools, send their representatives to the tournaments, which were, you know, it was the big tournaments where you had debate and you had all sorts of, you know, speeches and all the different kind of events, and one of the events was Student Congress. And they all send their representatives, and somebody puts forward a bill, and they give an authorship speech, and then you have people who argue in favor of it, and you have people who argue against it, and you have people who pay large amounts of money to get people to shut up, and never mind, that's now, never mind. I got to be really, really good at that. But the problem was you only won that by votes. The assembly voted on who won, and my school never sent anybody but me to that event. So I ended up with the reputation of like one of the guys that you had to beat to win, but who was never going to win because he never had a block to vote for him. So I was probably one of the top five guys in the northern part of the state. There was a northern and southern district. I was like one of the top five guys in the north, one of the guys you had to beat to win, but it was like, yeah, Looker never wins. You don't have to worry about him. You do have to beat him, but he's not going to win. So that was a little disappointing. But one of the great things about that, and this is one of those in hindsight, I remember a time when the rules were such that you had to give speeches to win, obviously. And I had gotten to a place where I had to get another speech in, and the tournament was coming to a close. So they were like, anyone who wants to speak affirmatively on this, please rise. And I was like, well, I got to get a speech in. So I stood up, and they called on somebody else. Like, crud. And so the guy gave a speech, and they said, anyone who wants to give a speech for the negative, please rise. I stood up. And this went on like 3 or 4 times. Affirmative? Yeah, that'll mean. Negative? Oh, okay, that'll mean me. I would have said, you know, anything. But I... public speaking became very, very natural for me. It became something that didn't bother me at all. I have friends and colleagues who are teachers who the thought of getting up in front of people paralyzes them with fear. I'm like, you're a teacher. You stand up in front of like 30, 40 hellions every day and like standing in front of 5 adults and you're like, you're going to pee your pants? What's wrong with you? And I was like 14, and I, you know, probably a little bit of arrogance in there, but I thought I like ruled the roost. I was no fear. And part of it was that I was actually really good at it. Yeah, there you go. You can afford to be, you know, when you're good. But anyway, I had the ballots to back me up. Anyway, but I also mentioned that my school didn't have a football team, okay? Stanton was a nerd school. Still is. Still is a nerd school. They have a football team now, but it sucks because they're a nerd school. That's another nerd school. That's no accomplishment. It's like Battle of the Nerds. In my day, they like really rocked in Brain Brawl, but... so because we didn't have a football team, what we did was we went out and we lived in Bay Meadows, right? So we went out on the third fairway and we played football on the third fairway, okay? So we went out and played on the third fairway and like the tee was one end zone and the green was another, okay? Because it's where you had to play football. And there was one time that we went out there and everybody has a nickname when they play football, right? So mine was... Butterfingers, because I couldn't catch a cold, okay? I was good for hitting people if they were close, because God knows I couldn't catch them, right? But one day, I actually caught a pass, and I caught it, and I turned, and I planted, and that 95-pound son of a gun hit me just right, and just spun me, and my knee stayed right exactly where I planted it. And I tore my ACL, my MCL, and my cartilage. And that one ended up in the operating room. That's a funny story, but that's a different one. I'll tell you that one later. Yeah, that one was a knee surgery. That was really unpleasant. It took a long time to recover from. It was right before I turned 16. So I actually didn't get my driver's license on time because I was like in an immobilizer that went from my hip all the way down to my ankle. There's a homecoming picture where all of my friends have their girlfriends, and the girlfriends are standing here, and they're like, and my girlfriend is standing here, and she's in front of me. And the reason being is she's standing in front of my brace so that you can't see it, right? My crutches are laying down on the ground, so take it for what it's worth. Yeah, that one was really, that was no fun. But, okay, we'll get to that later. So, going back to debate, I was at a tournament, I think it was Winter Park, it might have been Buchholz, if anybody knows those high schools down in Orlando. We used to travel all around Florida at these things, and they were tons of fun because we'd get up early, we'd drive down to these places, we traveled to Florida State, we traveled to Florida, we did these tournaments over there. Did you ever have classes in Diffenbaugh? Yeah, so we had tournaments that staged in Diffenbaugh all the time. That's the one building that I remember there. We did a couple tournaments at University of Florida. There was a Blue Key tournament that we did there. You had all these high school kids running around acting like they were big stuff on college campuses. But at either Winter Park or Buchholz down in Orlando, we had stopped at a McDonald's early to get breakfast, and I think I got like a bad burrito because my stomach felt like somebody was going like Muhammad Ali on it. And I just felt terrible, okay? But show must go on, right? I mean, you gotta win, gotta, you know, give your speeches. So I'm like sitting in this little theater desk kind of thing, doubled over, paying attention, and they would say, "Does anyone have any questions for the author?" And I would stand up. Except I would stand up and I'd fake it. I'd be like, and they, you know, they would call for speeches, and I'd get up and I'd give a speech, and I'd just, you know, what, you know, totally faking it. And I would get back to my seat, and it would like I would exhale and be like, oh, I would just like double because I felt horrible. And so they called for a lunch break, and I was like, okay, fine. I can go like crawl into a hole. My friends will take care of me for a few minutes. I had a couple of real good friends that were girls that were going to be like, oh, it's okay. We'll get you some food. We'll take care of you, something like that. And I like went to sit up, and this girl on the front row across the aisle turns around, and she looks at me and she says, "You have a very arrogant persona." Thank you. That's the worst pickup line ever. But, yeah, hashtag truth. But I'm like, okay, game face. And we have like the most snarky little conversation ever for like 5 minutes. And then she goes off to her group and I go off to my group. And we end up talking a little bit more after lunch, kind of flirty in this sort of backhanded way. And, you know, I'm telling my friends about her later, and I was like, I think this girl was like, I think she was into me. It was kind of weird. And so I think we went to a Sonny's for lunch or for dinner on the way home because it's like 5 o'clock. We're supposed to be traveling back to Jacksonville. It's like, And again, I was still feeling like death warmed over. So everybody's having their, you know, barbecue sandwiches or platters, whatever. I think I've got like a thing of tea in front of me, and I'm laying on this like sticky table, right? Because I feel horrible. And I just, for some reason, I sit up, because probably I'm tired of laying on a sticky table. And as I sit up, she like walks right past me. She's like, "Hey, Scott." Hey, that was her, by the way. It's like smooth. Anyway, so get home. My grandmother was throwing some sort of dinner party that night, and I made this like really brief appearance at the party because I had to go make an appearance at grandma's party. And I went home and I went to bed because, again, death, right? So that night, I have this dream, and she's in this dream. And it's a very striking, very abrupt dream about this girl. And I wake up, and I don't know, I really don't remember if I heard it, like audible voice, or if I just knew it, but I knew this girl was going to have a tremendous impact on my life. I don't remember if I heard it said or if I just knew it, but it was tremendous impact on your life. It was like, dang. Wow. Okay. So, I mean, this was like 1992-ish, 3-ish, somewhere around in there. There was no Google. There was like a phone book. And there were like 18 entries with that last name in it. And I had no idea what her dad's last name was. So how are you going to look that up? The 90s were hard, kids. Okay? So some time went by. It was only like a couple days. I was telling some friends about her. I was actually talking to a friend. I was talking to a friend about her, and she called me. Okay? And we ended up dating for like 2 years, but within the first like 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks of us actually like hanging out, talking on the phone, all that, I remember very clearly because I was standing in the kitchen. It was in the kitchen going into the dining room because the 90s were hard, kids. You had telephones that had wires that connected to walls, so you could only go so far. So I was like kind of back and forth on the phone. And you didn't know who was calling you. So when she called, I was like, I wonder who this is. Hello? Anyway. So she was talking to me about going to church and all those things about church and how her family went to church and her family did this and her family and her church and her pastor and her youth pastor and all this, and it's like, it's kind of like when the fog clears and all of a sudden you see something in front of you and you thought you had an idea of what it was and it turns out it's different. And I went, clear as day, I remember this. Oh my God, I'm dating a Bible banger. Uh-huh. Anyway, so she was the one who actually started me going to church. And of course, she got me going to the largest Roman Catholic church in town. That's not at all true. It was a dinky little independent charismatic church on Atlantic Boulevard. It's still there. It's not called the same name. It was called Living Bread. And actually, that was where I first met Sharon. Remember Living Bread with Glenn Cotton? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that was a long time ago. I met Sharon before I met any of the rest of you people, except Mom and Dad. And yeah, so my first experience with church is as anything that I really have recollection of was this independent charismatic church, which was a really interesting experience. And it was. And we were there for about a year and a half. And my girlfriend was nannying for a family. And they were going to a different church. And they needed someone to babysit their kids' church classes. And so they asked her to babysit for their kids' church classes. And she did. And she was making some money off of that. And they, that was a Spanish service because the mother in the family was Spanish. She was Latina. And so she went to the Spanish service, and they had this Spanish church and all this kind of stuff. And so, yeah, arriba, viva Latinas. And so she just, you know, did their kids' church. You might have heard of these people. This was Hank and Isa Groff. Anybody? Okay. And they were going to this, you know, crazy Spanish church called El Macias. So at a certain point in time, the people at this independent charismatic church started getting really kind of rude and intrusive and saying things that were just really kind of awkward that really didn't have any business saying. And the my girlfriend's family decided they were going to leave that church, and they decided to switch over to the gringo church that went along with El Macias, Church of the Messiah. And that was how I ended up going to Church of the Messiah. So that was right after I had graduated high school. I actually graduated high school attending Living Bread. So I ended up going to college at the University of New Orleans, or University of Loyola, New Orleans, which was a Jesuit school in New Orleans, and it was a blast. I loved it. But for as much fun as I had, for as much of a tremendous education as I got, there was this one aspect that was very lonely. There was nobody there that was like me in terms of spirituality. Okay, there were no charismatics that I never found anybody like that. I'm sure maybe they were out there, but I never found them. Okay, so for that whole time, I just kind of played liturgical Christian, which I was. But it was like, okay, I'm only being like half of who I am. So after my first semester of being at Loyola, my girlfriend and I broke up. It was a bad breakup. It was a mutual thing, though. She said she didn't want to be with me anymore, and I don't take that from anybody. So we were just done. She wanted more space. I wanted more commitment. It just wasn't going to work out. So, but let me tell you, when debaters break up, yeah, it was nasty. It was no fun at all. But I had just bought tickets to this Church of the Messiah youth group Christmas ball on a boat. It was on the Annabelle Lee, if anybody's ever been on the Annabelle Lee. And they were expensive, okay? They were like $25 a ticket, something like that. And so I had just bought these two tickets for us to go before we had broken up. And she was like, well, we're not going to go. And I was like heck we're not going to go. I just spent $50 on this. You know, we're adults. We can behave ourselves. We can be civil. No, we couldn't. We sat there at dinner and made everyone at the table feel really awkward. And as soon as dinner was over, she went one way and I went the other. We didn't get within 20, like, we didn't get within 50 feet of each other, and everyone was much happier about that. So at the end of the night, she came up to me and was like, I'm going home with friends. And I was like, fantastic. I am too. And because while she had gone one way and I had gone the other, I had ended up getting together with people like Mark Sowell, Rob Shepard, Scott Duggar, Jesse Drost, and I had ended up really hitting it off with these guys, and they're like, hey, we're going back to Rob's house, and we're going to have a bonfire. And we had a blast. And so for many years after that, we ended up being great friends. And basically, whenever I came back from college, these people were my peers. These were my friends. Hang out with these guys. And Messiah's young adult group was like my social group when I came back in town. Now, when I left town, yeah, that kind of went away because it wasn't like you had Facebook. You couldn't really maintain long-distance relationships like you can now. But I graduated, one other thing. In between my freshman and sophomore year, I was in the youth group with Church of Messiah, freshman and sophomore year of college. Father David had gone back and was praying for the youth, and he was doing his whole postmaster thing. He was reading people's mail like it was just his own stuff to go through. And he was laying hands on people, and they were dropping like flies. And I was catching because, it was 20 years ago. I had a much better back. And afterwards, everything's kind of winding down. And if you remember, Messiah had really thick window sills at that time. And so you could go back and you could just plop down on those window sills and just kind of chill on the window sills. And he's like, "You, come here." Okay. And he says, "I don't know you from Adam, but you're called to be a priest." And then he went down a list of about four or five different things that I'd done for years and says, "You're called to be a priest. You're supposed to do this, supposed to do this, supposed to do this." Huh. Okay then. Well, so if that's true, what am I supposed to do next? You need to make an appointment to see the archdeacon. Who's that? Me. Okay. So, but when he said this, I immediately knew it was true. I walked around on like cloud nine for like 3 weeks. This was the coolest news I had ever gotten. One, because everything that he said was absolutely true. You've done this. Yes, I have. Every service in, you're walking around going, "Well, you know, if I was in charge." Okay, it was a long time ago. But, nailed me on everything. Okay, so, absolutely. And he says, "Okay, well, you need to finish up college, get your degree. The subject you're getting your degree in is fine. When you're done, you need to go to seminary, and you can either go to Oral Roberts University, the bastion of crazy charismatic universities, pass, Trinity Episcopal School for Ministry, which is a very conservative, very evangelical school in the Episcopal Church. I went on their website, and the big thing that they had, the banner, they had just had a professor publish a book sort of reacting to the Episcopal bishop who said that there was no resurrection and Jesus never came back from the dead. And so their response was, "Can a bishop be wrong?" I don't want to get involved with any of this nonsense. No. Third place, Nashota House. Okay, what is this place? This sounds wacky. This sounds like some, like, we pulled some Hebrew word out of the Bible and like, "Yeah, let's do this." Well, actually, it's an Indian word, and it's this, like, 150-year-old Episcopal monastery up in the middle of nowhere, Wisconsin. And I ended up going there, and it was a monastery. It's not quite a monastery, but it was essentially a monastery. And it really, for all intents and purposes, it was a monastery. You were a long way from any place civilized. And we got up at 7:30 every morning for morning prayer and Eucharist every day. We were only required to be there Monday through Friday, but they did it on Saturday and Sunday as well. And if you were on the rotation that was required to do the duty, you had to be there. At 4:30, we had evening prayer every day. Every student had required jobs that they were required to do. You all had to do in sort of Benedictine tradition of work, study, and pray. So everybody had to do their morning and evening prayers. Everyone had to do a job to uphold the campus. And then you obviously had to do your studies. So for 3 years, I kind of lived a monastic life with, you know, my 30 closest friends. Now, about half of those guys were married, and they didn't have the same sort of experience that I did, but it was very similar, okay? And it was a really intense, very grounding prayer time. If you think about what it's like to live in a place where you go back like 300 years and people are singing the Psalms every night in Gregorian chant, when you have sung services all the time, when, I mean, you're doing like literally Benedictine chant, we rose and fell by a one-ton bell in the middle of the yard that was the student's responsibility that rotated each week. You had to go out and grab a rope that was like that thick, reach up and ring this bell, and that was how people knew what time it was. All right, and when that bell rang, everyone stood up, made the sign of the cross, and said a certain set of prayers. You stopped what you were doing. You could be walking down the street and you would hear that bell ring. You could hear it for miles and everyone would stop. Cars would stop. Okay? And it was, we didn't even have like regular calendars. We basically lived and died by the liturgical calendar. I remember being in a conversation with my mother about when I was going to come back home, and I said, well, I need to be home by Easter or by Pentecost, but I want to be here for Ascension, so I'll probably leave after Ascension, but I'm going to be home by Pentecost. And she had no idea what I was talking about. She's like, when's Ascension? Well, it's 40 days after Easter. Can you be a little bit more like Tuesday-ish? No. Okay. So in my last year up there, in my last semester, I had arranged a job interview with Father Jim Nylon. He was looking for an associate, and I was going to go down and visit his church. And it was not the plan for me to come back here. I was going to go visit his church. He needed an associate. I was probably going to be his associate. We had called. He was enthusiastic about it. I had sort of the phone interview. He said, you know, arrange a ticket. I'll buy it. You'll come down for an interview. We'll go from there. Okay. I had gone to breakfast. I don't remember what day it was, but we'd gone to breakfast. It was March. We had had a really hard snow, and there were still some patches of ice on the ground. Went to morning prayer, and I was heading to breakfast, and I found the last patch of ice on the ground, and I destroyed my knee. Same knee that I hit in football, the ACL, MCL, meniscus thing. This one was, yeah, it was just bad. I destroyed the bottom of my thigh bone and did something to the patella and car. It was really, really bad. The doctor ultimately said there's a 50% chance that you're going to need, that this surgery will work, and if it doesn't work, you're going to have your knee replaced. I was like 24. Awesome. So I remember laying in the snow with my friend standing around me and my history professor, my Old Testament professor, who I really was not fond of, comes up and looks down at me and says, did you fall? Now, apparently, I was in so much pain, and the look that I gave him was so venomous that he actually took a step back. I later went and apologized. So I ended up having an MRI. The doctor was supposed to go on vacation, but he calls me back and says, holy cow, your MRI is so bad. Can you go in and get your pre-op done tomorrow and have your surgery on Friday before I leave town on Saturday? Okay. So I call up mom and I'm like, mom? And my parents literally dropped everything and like hopped in the car for a 20-hour drive to get from Florida to Wisconsin with the dog, and they came up for the surgery, okay? And then, with the dog, yeah, it was a little dog, and I ended up going back to recover in Florida. Some of you remember me being around with a wheelchair for a while. So I recovered for about 3 months in Jacksonville before I went back and finished up in Wisconsin. I finished up the last like month in Wisconsin. But here was the neat thing. As I finished up in Wisconsin, my dad went up with me. And he was able to spend about 3 weeks up there at the end, probably 2 weeks at when I had the initial surgery. So he spent almost 6 weeks up at Neshota House with me. And they were really, really cool about letting him be a part of the community. So he was able to go to morning and evening prayer and participate in the Eucharist. And I think they even got to ring the bell a couple times. And they're like, yeah, sure, less work for us. But, you know, they got to go to a couple classes and sit in and observe those classes. And basically got to be a part of this really powerful ancient spiritual tradition, which was very, very moving for him, okay? And at the time, it completely sucked for me. I didn't get to finish up my senior year with my friends who I was going to, like, God knows when I was going to see these guys again, because we're going to all be shipped off to different parishes, different denominations, different everywheres. I haven't seen any of these people in like, I don't know, 10 years. So I'm not going to get to spend this time with them. When I am, I'm going to be like, you know, gamey and crippled and all this kind of nonsense. And it was really, really frustrating. Wheelchair and doing leg lifts and not able to bend my leg or put any weight on it. It was horrible. But it was really cool that my dad got to be part of this really cool religious experience. And it was pretty impactful for him. So, this is where we kind of like shift gears here and kind of wrap it up, because I'm going along like everybody else. So, years later, things have changed, and I am getting ready to preach on Good Friday. I think this was 2 years ago. And that was the year that my dad was also preaching as well. So I was thinking to myself that morning about what an amazing privilege it was to be able to preach at an event like that with one's father. Amen. That's just an amazing opportunity. So few people ever get. And I was thinking back to, you know, all those debate trips and how that prepared me for getting up in front of people and talking. And how being in front of people doesn't bother me because I've been doing it since I was 14. And compiling information and turning it into a speech and presenting it doesn't bother me because I've been doing it since I was so young. And I was thinking about how that injury to my knee was a starting point for a process that ended with, not ended, but had led to a point where I was going to be able to stand with the priests of Messiah and my father and two other gentlemen and preach the word of God to a congregation. And I was just overwhelmed by how amazing that was. And after having two knee surgeries, I don't always have the best joint days. Okay? There's sometimes where these joints are not my friends. Okay? And that particular morning was not a good morning for these knees. And I got up, and they reminded me that they'd had surgery twice, and that it was probably a cold morning. And it was not a good morning. And I kind of grumbled a little, and I reflected on it a little bit more. And I said to myself, well, I suppose a few aches and pains aren't that much when it comes to someone's salvation. Amen. And I heard God say, that's what I thought. And so, the paths that we go on are paths that are really challenging at the time. But as God says in the prophet Isaiah, your ways are not my ways, says the Lord, and your thoughts are not my thoughts. For as the heavens are high above the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.